Well, it's just us for the podcast tonight, Hobart. Yeah, okay. Have you eaten dinner? All right, I'll order us some pizza. What do you want on yours? I doubt they have wallaby, wombat, and kookaburra on pizzas. I'm sorry, you're going to have to do something else. Just plain? Okay. A little basil? That's fine. A little bit koala? No, I'm sorry, you can't have that. Hi, it's Paul Dini, and I'm sitting here with Hobart and also with Ezra tonight. It's just the three of us doing the old podcast. Misty has taken Deuce and Muggsy to the vets, and they're on their way back, but I don't think they'll make it in time. Rashi took the keys to my car and lit out for parts unknown. Superica has a date with Miss Damore, and I weep for him, especially, because I think that Chippy's no good for him at all. And that's it. That's where we are. That's where we are tonight. As we kind of wind our way through summer, it's not nearly the end of summer. It's sort of like the middle of August.
I've been seeing all the hooray my kids are going back to school posts and stuff online.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
you can't wait for the kids to get back to school if you're a parent.
Yeah.
And I've actually seen more than a few, it's not too late, Christmas catalogs have shown up already.
Oh, you know, wow. Like,
order now. You can still, if you order now, you can have delivery by the 23rd of December. It starts earlier and earlier every year.
Yeah.
I guess because the economy is so bad in America, they do whatever they can to pump up the holidays and get you spending.
Yeah.
For overpriced gifts for people you don't normally speak to but feel compelled to go out and buy for. It's insane. But the Christmas catalogs have been showing up. The Halloween catalogs have been here since the middle of June.
I was just realizing it's almost Halloween. Now I got to think about my costume.
What are the candidates for this year?
I'm leaning towards Krieger from Archer.
Oh, okay.
Because I like going with bearded characters because I don't want to shave.
Yeah.
And that's the forefront right now. I like that idea.
Well, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. I have no idea. I'll come up with some last-minute inspiration, I'm sure. last year was the Cheshire Cat, and that worked really well because I just got big old Japanese pajamas. I guess they make them in the shape of Disney characters and put that on and basically just hung out. So this year, I have no idea. I have no idea what's happening for Halloween. I can't even think that far ahead.
Yeah,
it's been kind of a crazy month. It's been crazy since Comic-Con, just coming back and running and running and getting the Hulk show on the air and getting started on new projects and a zillion different things. So and no real solid vacation time for this summer. You know, a weekend here or there is like the best we can do. Around my birthday, we had a couple of couples come over. We had Spike and Tony and Spencer and Allison and a couple of other couples and just did it like that, and then we went away to Pebble Beach, Carmel, for a bit of a long weekend. Had a great weekend with my mom and my relatives up there, and just really terrific time. And now we're back, kind of chewing through the end of summer, and Labor Day's coming up, but no Labor Day, you know, no Labor Day holiday, nothing. We're just gonna stay in and maybe see a movie or something.
Yeah.
I always like Labor Day because that was like a day. When we were kids, we'd still be up at Lake Tahoe at least through Labor Day and then come back the first week of September. We'd go up there at the end of July and we'd just be gone for an entire month. And I miss that. When you're an adult, you don't have the luxury of just being gone for a big chunk of the summer unless...
Yeah, how did our parents do it?
The way that my folks did was my dad would come up on the weekends. He, you know, now I'm going through what he would do. He's like, you know, the poor sucker would have to work during the week, and then my mom would be up at the lake house with us kids, you know.
Oh, okay.
It was idyllic, you know. Let's go to Lake Tahoe. All right, like a month at Lake Tahoe. And we'd spend part of the time. It was not really our house. It belonged to some close friends. They were almost like our cousins. They had the lake house, and they had a ranch nearby near Carson City. So during the week, we go and hang out at the ranch and ride horses and ATVs and shoot guns and all that kind of fun cool stuff. And then the weekends we go to the lake house and just kick back and sit in hammocks or float in inner tubes. I saw some old home movies of us recently, and I was like, oh man, those were the days. And so we would just be up there bumming around and relaxing, and then Dad would come up and join us on the weekends, and Mom would sit in the kitchen with her friend Peggy and cook and various relatives. It was good stuff. Now you don't really have that luxury unless you have the wherewithal to, you know, one, own a cabin somewhere, and two, have, you know, take time off. My brother has that luxury because he's a school teacher, and he can take a big chunk of the summer off because most of his pupils are gone. But then he has to show up a little earlier than everybody else, and I think he's showing this week is when he starts coaching high school football. So that's something a job I wouldn't have, is to be out in 90-degree heat running kids around a field.
And, tell me about it. I saw some kids doing it just the other day, and it was almost 100 degrees. I can't believe that.
Yeah. And he teaches up in Monterey, and it's usually very temperate up there and very cool.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, the worst part of the year is end of August through the beginning of October. September is always a scorcher. You're wondering, where's that nice fog rolling in that I saw we had in February through June, you know, and it's like, it's not there, boy. I mean, you know, you sports in Monterey, when I went to high school up there, you'd bake and sweat in the summer, and football looks so odious to me. Both football and baseball looks so damn uncomfortable to me. It's like, I'll take swimming, I'll take water polo, I'll take anything where I can get in a pool, or I'll take track where I can just run off into the woods and no one's watching me. You know,
I chose fine arts over that. I just did drama and choir, and I never really did any sports.
We had to do sports. We had so I did either track or swimming or lacrosse. And lacrosse was always a wintertime thing. And then you get the reverse of it. Then you get the skunky, heavy, you know, the rain and the cold, the miserable cold and the foggy cold that just sort of pulls at you. And then you're out there, you know, slinging a basket on a stick around, wondering how long is it till football practice can get warm again. But my brother coaches both football and lacrosse, so he's got both ends. But he's a lot more athletic than I am. I gave up athletics a long time ago. I mean, I have season tickets to the Lions. That's about as much as I go into athletics.
Than me.
Yeah. So I'm no more athletic than the team I root for. Sorry to all you Lions fans out there. But you know what I'm talking about, guys.
I kid because I love.
I kid because I... Yeah. Yeah, why not? Sure, why not? So anyway, but it's still real hot around here in Southern California. So I think we're in for some scorcher days until at least the end of October. And it's fire season.
Yeah.
Yeah. The end of the summer is when you get fire season and bear season. You get bears.
What a combo.
Yeah. Sometimes you're really lucky you get a bear on fire coming running down into your house. That's a lot of fun when you're camping or you're hiking on a trail. It's like, whoa, bear on fire coming through. You don't want to get out of his way, boy. But up in the hills around here, around the hills above Pasadena, Altadena, Monrovia, and everything, they're just swarming with black bears, thirsty black bears that come out of the hills and hit the hot tubs and the pools and anything they can get to cool off and get some food. So
and steal your trash.
Steal your trash. Yeah, like we saw online, you know, bear picking up just pushing off a dumpster and walking away with it. That's one pretty inventive bear, my man. It's pretty good. So what else? What else has been going on? Not a whole lot. Anything in the news worth talking about?
Unfortunately, the only thing I noticed today was Elmer Leonard's passing.
Yeah, that was too bad.
Yeah, although he has had a long, full career.
87.
I couldn't believe he's been writing as long as he has. 310 to Yuma was a remake of his original film back in, what, the 50s or 40s or something?
Started off as a Western writer.
Yeah.
Yep. And
he's known for his mob type, you know, con man movies and books and stuff.
Get Shorty and things like that. Yeah. Good stuff. Terrific writer. And let's see. What else? Oh, there was that ghastly story in the news today about that poor Australian baseball player.
Hmm.
There was a young man who came from Australia to play baseball on a college scholarship. He was in Oklahoma. Three kids blew him away. They just saw him jogging by the side of the road and said, "Let's go kill that guy." And they said, "Okay."
Like the end of Easy Rider or something.
Yeah, they pulled up, shot him in the back to show you how brave they are. And then they turned themselves in. It's like, "Why'd you do it?" It's like, "We were bored."
Oh my goodness.
You were bored. Okay.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know why due process exists for scum like that. I mean, you know, we were bored, so we killed a guy. We wanted to see him die, you know, and here we are. We turned ourselves in. Well, thank you for turning yourselves in. Now off to the guillotine with you. I don't know why, you know, why are we going to waste taxpayer money on this? They admitted it. I'm sure they can do some fast forensics work, find that the gun they used belonged to one of them, and, you know, off, you know, chop, chop.
Yeah.
If they're that callous about killing somebody, I really believe that's, you know, why do we bother, you know, getting into their heads? Why do we try and, what are they going to try and prove, that they were insane? No, they admitted they were bored.
Yeah. I mean, it's what's just, rehabilitation going to do?
Lock them up.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll find plenty of things to do in prison. Hmm. You know, if they're bored, they can spend the rest of 60, 70 years in prison, or, you know, 6 months, and then get a lethal injection if that's going to, you know, perk them up a little bit. When you read something like that, you wonder where the hell is society headed? You know, why are we doing things that, you know, so horrible things like that? I don't know. The world is really a mixed bag these days. There's unrest all over. There's, you know, I don't know what is happening in Egypt. I've tried to figure it out.
It's insane over there right now.
Everybody's jockeying for position, for power. There's so much. So, you know, there's so much duplicity and evil and grasping for, I don't know, wealth and power in the world that it just, you know, it tends to almost blot out the few good things. And you don't hear a lot about good things. You just hear, like, you know, if you eat this, it's deadly for you. You know, look what's online. Eat this, don't eat this, but don't eat that either. And don't eat anything. And if you don't eat anything, you're bulimic. And then you need to be analyzed. And then everything. Oh, don't even think about your problems. Worry about some celebrity's problems.
Yeah.
Can we worry any bit more about, you know, how short Miley Cyrus's hair is, or who's stoned and drunk and who's in rehab and everything like that? It's like the new version of Bread and Circuses. We don't fix on our own lives. We don't worry about fixing our own lives. We worry about society wants us to keep focused on some celebrity somewhere, somebody who we normally wouldn't watch on television, but somehow we're supposed to feel some empathy for, because they've made some wrong choices with their lives or something like that. There's got to be some good news.
Well, on the broader side, Emily and I recently renewed our passes to the zoo.
There you go.
And the hippos are back.
The hippos are back.
At least one hippo.
Oh, good.
Apparently, the one that was there before, a couple years ago, Otis, they decided to find him a mate, sent him down to San Diego. He hooked up with someone and gave birth to a son named Adama.
Oh, really?
And Adama's now 2 years old. And
like Battlestar Galactica. Adama.
I think it was named after some sort of Portuguese word or something.
Oh, okay.
But it's similar, yes.
Yeah.
He's 2 years old and he's been there 2 months now.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So.
And so Otis just cruised back.
Otis is probably going to come back at some point, but so far it's just his kid now.
So is Otis like a deadbeat dad? You know, like, yeah. I hooked up down south, and once the kid showed up, the gal was looking a little, shall we say, hippie for, you know, being a hippo. So I decided better split, head up back north where, you know, I don't want to be tied down. No, actually, I don't think hippos are monogamous. I think they're just sort of, you know, they're all rolling around in a river somewhere, and it's, you know.
Yeah,
all good.
Gotta say, for 2 years old, this guy's pretty big.
Oh, well, the baby?
Yeah.
Hippos are, they're amazing creatures. Nasty. They're the most deadly creature in Africa, I heard. You know, they just go out of your way to kill people. But, you know, Walt Disney and all the other cartoonists have made them into such lovable, chunky, fun, roly-poly creatures. And they're really not. They're just vicious. They're worse
than
rhinos.
One of my favorite animals, I gotta admit.
Yeah, they are.
I'm adorable, and
Oh, well, there's a lot of animals I like, but I wouldn't get in a cage.
That's true.
No way. I wouldn't get in a cage with most things.
Yeah.
Years ago, I adopted a Tasmanian devil for the LA Zoo, and I got a tour to go see it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I got up close to it, and it's like, you want to want to go see it. And it's like, oh, I can see it fine from here. I had no desire to touch that thing. Although I did pick one up, and when I was in Tasmania, I had a ranger pick one up and hold it out and like kind of held it.
It's like, here.
Yeah, it was like holding a very angry blender or something. And it was going to like lunge for my face. And it was actually clawing against me to try and snap at my chin.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Like, take it back. Take it back. There's good news in the zoology world. The Olenghito. Did you read about the Olenghito?
No.
The Olenghito is the newest scientific discovery of a carnivorous mammal in the Western Hemisphere. It was discovered in South America recently.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when they announced it last week, it's like, oh, there's this great find that just happened. But the reality is like, if you're a zoologist, you spend years analyzing and it's very rare that you find something and then the next day it's in all the papers. You have to classify what it is and get samples of it. And then only months later or even years later, you announce your discovery, which can be kind of interesting, especially in some of these ecologically sensitive areas. They're being bulldozed, you know, miles at a time. So you, as a zoologist, you might go in and you might discover some interesting animal, and then, you know, by the time you announce your discovery, it's long extinct because that area was bulldozed and, you know, or strip mined or something like that. Well, the Olenghito is actually a member of a family called the Olingos. There's a species of raccoon. Well, there's the raccoon family, and that includes such animals as the common raccoon and the Mexican crab-eating raccoon, and then animals like the coati and the kinkajou. And what the Olingo is more of a relative of the kinkajou, and it's a kind of a more weasel-like member of the raccoon family. It looks not unlike the ringtail that we have out here in California, the ring-tailed cat that you might see out in the desert late at night, you know, like a very thin, stretched-looking cat-like raccoon with a long black and white ring tail. The Olingos are kind of more related to the ringtail than the standard raccoon. But now they've discovered a smaller member of the Olingo family, which they call the Olenghito, or the smaller Olingo, and it looks like a woolly kinkajou, where the kinkajou has, you know, the little honey bear has smooth fur. This one looks a little darker and fuzzier. And it was discovered because a zoologist was doing work on the Olingo family, classifying them, and then he found some strange skins that were thrown in with them. And it's like, this doesn't look like any Olingo I know. And then he looked up the area it was from, did some more research, found some more pelts, and actually discovered that this creature had been shipped to a zoo in the 70s as an Olingo, and it never mated with any other Olingos, and that was because it wasn't one. So he went down, looked for it, and then he found the Olenghito, which is a little monkey-like member of the raccoon family that hops around the trees and eats figs. And even though it's a carnivore, it's a pretty mild-looking little carnivore. It's not anything savage, I don't think.
Smaller mammals.
That's what we're looking at mostly these days. I don't think we're going to discover anything big like a new species of tiger or elephant or things like that. Even ocean-going mammals, I think, with the exception of some subspecies of dolphins, I think they're all pretty much discovered. But as far as the big type of mammal, but there still exists rooms for subspecies and different family members. Something like the raccoon family or the civet family, where there are many different variations. I think that you can always find a new subspecies or a new type of those type of animals. And there are animals in Borneo that they're discovering that they have pictures of that this one has stripes on its belly, not on its back, like the northern Linzang. This was more of, like a banded Linzang, but its whiskers go a different way, you know. So
this is fascinating to me because, like, when you mentioned that it was shipped to the zoo, I was like, how could that happen? Like, a zoo not know this is a different animal? But then I was, as you describe it, how do you keep these all separate and like catalog? How do you even know which is a new animal? There's so many.
Well, you know, it's like there are infinite variations. Like,
yeah.
you know, there's like the, for instance, the mongoose, you know. there are a lot of different types of mongooses. There's the Indian mongoose, there's the African mongoose, there's a banded mongoose, mm-hmm. there's all these different things. And then you get to an animal that's a relative of the mongoose, but clearly different, like the meerkat. And, yeah. You know, even though it's a member of the mongoose family, it's not technically the same as the Indian mongoose. But it is sort of similar. So, you know, that's where the hard work of zoology comes in. You know, you're not going to find, like I said, a Dr. Seuss type animal like a lion with deer antlers and saber teeth, you know, lurking around anywhere. You're just not. All the big mammals, the big types of mammals have been discovered. Although you might find something like a bear that is, you know, markedly different than a bear in a similar bear someplace else. Like there are reports that they're in Siberia. There's one part of Siberia where there's a brown bear that's bigger than the brown bear in Alaska, you know, and or darker fur or something like that. So if they find, you know, evidence of that bear, they might say, oh, well, it's a different subspecies of brown bear, and hey, a brand new type of bear. But, you know, as far as people discovering a bear for the first time, you know, that's yeah. been done. You're not going to have anything quite that dramatic.
So I imagine all these zoologists are very specialized then.
Yeah.
They have to know the differences between each subgenre or
subspecies.
Species, mm-hmm. and yeah.
Yeah, it's something like, you know, it's like you know, the more you go into unexplored areas, the more, but within a certain ecosystem, the more you may find similar, you know, but different animals. Like, for instance, the last big mammal that I can think of that was discovered in the last 20 years or so was an animal called the dingiso, which was in northern New Guinea, in the New Guinea highlands. And that was a very unique species of tree kangaroo. Now, tree kangaroos have been around, you know, as long as people have known around Australia. The first settlers saw, you know, macropods up in the trees, you know, some, like small wallaby-sized, you know, animals up there. And they figured, well, it's a type of kangaroo that's evolved to live in the trees. And so the more they explored and the more they did research, the more they discovered there were different types and different families of tree kangaroo, but they're all still basically, you know, the a tree kangaroo type animal. Then they discovered this very unique form of tree kangaroo called the dingiso in New Guinea, which is dramatic looking. It's has very dramatic black and white coloration, and it has, you know, a black nose, white here. In some ways, it's not quite panda colored, but it's got similar, you know, striking black and white features. Not exactly the same pattern as a panda, but you know, it looks very bear like, you know, with a white belly and everything. And it's a tree kangaroo that spends more time on the ground than it does in the trees. And the natives consider it a sacred animal because it greets people by opening its arms and making a welcoming sound. Now, scientists don't know if that's actually true or if that's as close as it comes to being threatening, or that's a defensive move to show how big it is in the hopes it frightens a predator away. But it's not a savage animal, and there are reports that natives have even caught them by slipping a rope over its neck and leading it away. You know, and it is very tame. When you get a dingiso, if you can get up to where they live, and it's very arduous getting to where they live. It's kind of a nightmare. You have to climb up in the mountains of New Guinea, and it's cold, and it's rainy, and, you know, it's kind of awful. But once you get up there, and once you can find one, you can just kind of pluck it out of the tree, and it'll just hold on to you, and you walk off with it. So but the natives consider it sacred because it does make welcoming gestures and signs. They believe it's the reincarnation of ancient ancestors, so they tend to leave it alone. So even though it's a rare animal, it's not, you know, getting hunted to extinction yet because most of the natives in the area leave it alone. But then again, there's a, you know, when you hear the name dingiso, it's kind of exotic. Like, what is this? What is this mysterious creature?
Yeah.
And then when you see it, it's like, oh, well, I kind of seen one of those before in a zoo or a museum. And but you don't know exactly what it is. It's like finding a new form of seal or weasel or something that you kind of know exists, but not like anything, like I said, anything dramatic, like a winged lion or you know, a French-speaking bear or something like that. I don't know.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Oh, mon ami.
I'm smarter than the average bear.
So, but anyway, that's nice. And, you know, that sort of offsets some of the awful news in the world. Last week was just the sight of this little fuzzy thing perched up into a tree.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice. So, but that's the good news as we have it. And, you know, as nobody's around this week for any witty banter with Miss Misty, who has some wonderful things to say lately about magic, and we'll have to do an all magic podcast next week.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
We got some great stuff. We've been going over some great stuff together, and she's made some sort of amazing creations in magic recently. So we'll have to have her talk more next week. But anyway, I thought we'd open it up and get some questions and hear where people's heads are at. So without more ado, let's have some
questions from the fans.
Questions from the fans. Yes, there we go. So we put the call out on Twitter earlier. So let's go over what the fans are thinking about. Alexis D. Meza says, "You're one of my favorite writers ever. Keep it." Okay, thank you very much. Not a question, but appreciated. JJ Hawkins says, "Why must you continue to be lulled to San Diego Con? We Dragon Con folks miss you and Misty. Will you ever come back?" Well, yeah, maybe they ask us to come back, and if we're guests, we certainly will. We love Dragon Con. It's a lot of fun. Dragon Con's this week, I think.
Oh, and, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. If I go next time, I want to go all steampunky. I want to get a Willy Wonka coat, you know, or yeah, look like an old style, you know, Jules Verne type guy, and the goggles and the top cat. Yeah, I'll
just, top cat. Just put him on your head.
It's like, oh, yes, steampunk. Yes, very good. I don't know what Officer Dibble will say about this, but we might be able to make a few bucks out of it. I don't know, a top hat.
Yes.
And so actually I do have a top hat. It looks kind of cool. I don't wear it often, but it's I'm not one for the big Mad Hatter top hats, but I do have a flat-brimmed, old-style, kind of old gambler-style top hat.
Yeah, that would work.
I'm fond of wearing, yeah. Let's see. Necrohammer writes, "Would you ever write a Batman Beyond live-action movie script? You think Kevin Conroy could play old Bruce?" I think Kevin Conroy could play anything or anyone. He is that good. And I did write a live-action Batman Beyond movie, and it never got made. Alan Burnett and I wrote it with Boaz Yakin about 10 years ago when the studio was interested in developing Batman Beyond potentially as a live-action franchise. And it was interesting that the movie kind of touched on all elements of Batman's life and then moved into Batman Beyond. So there was Terry McGinnis and Max and old Bruce Wayne and Ace and everything in it. But that was really kind of like the third of the movie. It was sort of like a progression of Batman's life that sort of finished up with Batman Beyond.
Fascinating.
And with him handing the cloak off to the suit off to Terry McGinnis. But you know what? It was more like the studio sort of wanted to investigate the possibilities of that. I think Batman Beyond was still sort of a new concept, and they really were at a crossroads wondering, where are we going to go with Batman? You know, do we want to take a chance and do a futuristic version? Do we want to jumpstart the whole thing? Do we want to continue on with the way we're doing? And then ultimately what they did, and I think was a very good choice, was they went with Christopher Nolan's take. And then we'll see what goes on, you know, for the future. I have no idea what they're planning on doing, but I know there's talk of a Superman Batman movie, a Justice League movie. I'm sure...
Are you ever interested or have any desire to make any of these scripts available for people to read, like online or anything?
No. I mean, you know, I would have some real problem with that too, because I think the draft that we did was okay as a first draft, but that's as far as it went.
Oh, okay.
And it was sort of mutual decision that it needed a lot of work. Mm-hmm. Everybody recognized it needed a lot of work. Boaz had another opportunity coming up, and I think he wanted to take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we realized, and the studio was sort of on the fence about pursuing Batman Beyond anyway. So we did, sort of by mutual decree, we decided not to do it. And the reason why I don't want anybody doing, you know, I don't want to put it out there, it was a first draft. And you know, warts and all. And I really don't like anybody reading a first draft of anything I'm working on unless, you know, it's another producer or a writer that I'm working with, because... I don't really, you know, that it's almost like reading a journal entry. It's it's really rough. It's really personal. It's got ideas that just are not going to work. And I remember what happened with J.J. Abrams some years back when he was developing Superman. He wrote a first draft script that had a lot of really strange ideas in it. Like, a lot of people were giving him ideas. He was taking a lot of notes from the network, as I understand, not the network, but the studio, I understand it. They were playing with a lot of different ideas, with a lot of different ways of re-envisioning Superman. And the script he was working on had all those very formative ideas. And that script got out. And a lot of people read it, and a lot of people hit the roof, and they went berserk about it.
Wow.
And somebody called me from a website, or like a fan site, and they said, can we have... And by that point, the script had gotten around. Somebody said to me, have you read the script? And I said, I have. And I said, can you make a comment about how terrible this is? And I said, well, can you make a comment about how terrible your attitude is?
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk about... I don't know about the script, but how dare you judge a writer on his first draft? You know... Come on, guys. This is stuff that was... This is first draft. You know, it's not going to get shot. There are ideas in here that he's just playing around with. Nobody's made any notes on this thing. I can guarantee you that whatever is in the script, you're not going to see it on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So don't get upset to me, and don't blow it all over. Can you imagine how insulting that is for a writer for his first draft to be blown out all over the internet?
And what a way to a journalist to act, like, not biased whatsoever. Oh, how do you hate it?
Well, that was the thing. It's like, I went on the warpath. You know, it's like, I would not show you a first draft of a Superman script that I've written, you know, like if I, you know, because a lot of times I write absolute crap the first time. I write very fast. And then I go through, and it's like panning for gold. I've got a dish full of mud here, and I have to shake it down until there are a couple of gold nuggets in there. And then I rewrite it again. So I went on the attack very solidly against everybody who read it. And as a result, I got a very nice letter from J.J. Abrams, and we've been friends ever since. So.
Right.
But, you know, it's like, come on, guys, really, you know, just... No, you're not sitting in the room. You're not taking the notes. You don't understand the writing process. You're so anxious to see the stuff on screen. But, you know, it's like, just simmer down, boys.
Yeah.
The first draft is never the one you're going to see.
After notes and all that stuff, what's the how many drafts is the most you've experienced?
What's that?
How many drafts have you gone through at the most? Like, after notes and all the critiques and back and forth or whatever, what's the most you've gotten in draft numbers?
Well, the movie stuff is always like an ongoing process.
Yeah.
I guess I did about four drafts of some of the Tower Prep stuff, you know, because that was all new stuff for a network,
yeah.
You know, just very new. I think I did four, maybe five drafts of the, I know I did at least four drafts of the pilot. And I know I did four or five drafts of the field trip episode. For whatever reason, that was a very hard one to work on because we were playing with some other ideas. And we had to change a lot to accommodate the economics of what we could and couldn't do. There was a scene on a bus. I wanted to have these unmarked vehicles on the Tower Prep campus.
Mm-hmm.
Very plain-looking things that you never even had a manufacturer's, you know, sticker on them, or very, you know, almost like riding in this complete white, you know, block on wheels. And then I was told, we don't have any sort of money for vehicles. Are you dreaming? We can't do a vehicle shot. We can't do a shot on in a bus. Where are we going to get money for a bus for them? So a lot of that had to be changed and reconfigured and stuff like that. So,
I'm sure things change a lot. I mean, I guess this week or something, the Star Wars comic is coming out by Dark Horse.
Yeah.
Which is the version of George Lucas's original script.
Oh, yeah. Good luck reading that.
Yeah.
I read some of his original drafts when I worked up Skywalker.
Yeah.
Some of his original drafts of movies. And it was like, wow. I mean, like the first draft of early drafts of Raiders of the Lost Ark. There are scenes in there that never are even hinted at in the movie.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, some of that stuff did make it into Temple of Doom.
Huh.
You know, there's a scene where Indy infiltrates a Chinese warlord's stronghold. And that whole scene with the gong from Temple of Doom and escaping and all like that. That's originally where the headpiece to the Staff of Ra was. And they used a lot of that, the action, in the second one. But... So you never really throw anything out, but, you know, I tend to rewrite and write a lot. So I'd say like four or five drafts is the most I've ever written anything.
Yeah.
Something amazingly, like something like Batman Beyond Return of the Joker was like two drafts, if that.
Wow.
I wrote that very quickly, and then again, I'd worked the story out pretty thoroughly. Tom and Jerry was like three drafts. But that was, again, you know, here's our notes, mm-hmm. and then notes, and then here's some more notes, and notes. Oh, and here, write another song for this part right here. Okay, you know.
Yeah.
So it was pretty quick. It was done in about 2 months. That's sort of the thing I don't understand is when I hear guys over at Disney talking about, you know, or at some studio saying, well, you know, we spent 3 years on the story. So 3 years on the story? If I get 3 months on a story, you know, I don't even get 3 months on a story to write a feature. Are you kidding me?
That Sweatbox movie where they broke the Emperor's New Groove storyline down from its changing from the original story about the Mayans. That's fascinating how long they dealt with that and how many times they had to try to break that story and deal with it and change it. And oh, I couldn't believe it.
Did you see that movie?
Yeah. It was on YouTube for a while. It might still be.
Oh, I want to see that.
Yeah, it's called The Sweatbox.
I've been wanting to see that for a long time.
Yeah, check it on YouTube. It hopefully is still there.
When I worked on the story for Maleficent, that was about 4 months back and forth. And I think the first thing I wrote was the best. Mm-hmm. And so, again, you know, I have no idea what the process was after I left the project.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess I'll see next year. Smells Rotten writes, ever wanted an action figure yourself as Harley Quinn a la Joker's Millions? God, no. Because I'm making one now and could hook you up. Oh.
No.
Oh, well, okay. Gee, that's sweet. Thank you, Smells Rotten, but no thank you. You know, although Bruce Timm would probably get a big laugh. You know, he could put that on his desk and get a big hee-haw out of that. So you may want to ask him if he wants it. I appreciate it. I'm glad you find it worth your while to make the thing. That's okay. No, I'm actually surprised George Lucas hasn't made one of me. Because I think he still has the rights to me. And once in a while at Comic-Con, I'll look over this huge rack of, you know, 30 walk from the left, you know, guy in helmet walking through bar, you know, and I half expect and half dread to see cartoon writer Paul Dini, you know, looking like the way I did when I worked on staff for him. I don't know. I think he actually does have the rights to my likeness.
Could be a marketing brilliance there. Like, these are all the people that ever worked on Star Wars toys.
Oh, yeah, I want a Joe Johnston action figure.
Already did everything else.
Where's my Ben Burt figure? He comes with a little sound mixing box.
I love that, yes.
I want a Ben Burt.
Yes, me too.
All right. You would, because I want a Ben Burt action figure.
That'd be amazing.
Figure. Yeah, let's do it. Okay, that's the new line. It's like people who've worked on Star Wars. Yeah. So, you know, you have the George Lucas figure.
Uh-huh.
You have the Ben Burtt. You have the Joe Johnston, the Dennis Muren. You have
Rob McQuarrie.
Rob McQuarrie. And because you have all the actors already.
Yeah.
Phil Tippett.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want a Phil Tippett action figure? I sure would.
Yeah.
And then you get down to the third and fourth and fifth tier guys like me who worked on the Ewoks cartoon and a couple of episodes of Clone Wars. And, you know, Henry Gilroy will have an action figure made. Henry Gilroy, Dave Filoni, and Paul Dini action figure set. Look at that. They're sitting in a writer's room, and they're all strangling each other in frustration. Oh, boy. That's rising malevolence story break, you know, with us all in the writer's room screaming at each other. Let's see. Paul D. Just Cicero, JLA3, please make Jack Ryder into Creeper for the next Arkham game. Well, I'm not working on the next Arkham game, but I will pass your suggestion along to the ether. And actually, they can't, because Jack Ryder was not Creeper in the last Arkham game, and that takes place long after Arkham Origins, which is now. So I doubt Ryder will be in it at all. Or if he is, he's in it purely as a newsman. For him to become Creeper, he'd have to become Creeper in a game that takes place long after that.
Unless he's been Creeper all along, and we just didn't introduce it, I guess. But
yeah. Reasons I'm Broke writes, what was the favorite thing you signed at San Diego Comic-Con? What was the favorite thing I signed at San Diego Comic-Con? Oh, is this a trick question? I don't know. Probably gave me something.
Yeah, exactly. It better be that...
it better have been my arm.
Yeah.
I saw
some guy had a giant poster from Mask of the Phantasm or something like that.
Yeah.
That was having pretty much everyone that ever worked on the show sign.
Yeah. Yeah. I've signed a few things like that. I've signed posters and cells and dishes, you know, like they made special collector's plates. I know I assigned at least one Harley and Ivy dish when I was down there.
In fact, Emily just picked up a Harley and Ivy dish with Boyd Kirkland's signature.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Let me see. I signed a few issues of Mutant Texas, and whenever somebody brings me a copy of Mutant Texas, I always fall in front of them and, you know, like, so thank you so much for buying Mutant Texas, my poor little unloved baby. And, it was so probably that was the favorite thing that I signed. I think I signed some other stuff too. You know, I like it when some kid will bring me like a drawing they've made of like Robin or something. And will you sign it? And I said, well, you drew it. And he goes, but I want you to sign it too. It's like, oh, that's sweet.
So yeah, that is. That's
I'll sign
nice.
That. Let's see. Mad Mike Kung Fu, that's a great name.
Yeah.
Mad Mike Kung Fu says, when do you commit to an idea and decide to take it to completion? Thanks for all that you do, sir. Well, that's one of the hardest things, is because like coming up with ideas is really easy for a writer. It's especially easy for me. That's my poor wife, you know? It's like, I got a great idea for something. It's like, hold that thought. I'm turning on my mental music. Ah, there we go. Okay, music is playing in my brain now. You had said something about an idea, and I'll go blah blah blah, idea, 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 and it might be a great idea. But then what? You know, it's only a great idea if you sit down and you write it, and you finish it up. When I commit to an idea for myself is like kind of when it crawls out of my brain, when I can't think of anything else to do. There are a lot of ideas that are percolating all the time, and it's like, oh, I got to finish that story about this, or there's this movie I want to write over here, or there's something like that. It's like when there's an idea that is just like crawling out of my brain, like Athena crawling out of Zeus's skull. That's when I actually, okay, I have to write this because I'm not going to sleep otherwise. Because I, you know, there's the work I have to do to get through the day, and there's, you know, the shows I'm producing and the things I'm writing for the show. So those are sort of take precedence. Mm-hmm. But when I commit to an idea, it's sort of like, a cheetah running down an impala or something. You know, once the idea is there, once I start working on it, I run and run and run and run and run and run and run until I pull it down. And it might take me a week and it might take me a month, but that's a month where I spend nothing but walking around the house, kind of muttering incoherently, and that's when I'm writing something with an eye toward finishing it. So once I get that sort of mania to do that and nothing else, that's when it works.
It sounds like writers, the people who are meant to write are those people. The people who are like, I have an idea and I'm not going to be satisfied until I get it out.
Yeah. I mean, I need to do more of that. I just need to, you know, spend time every day. Like, I need to get up at 4 a.m. and go exercise. Then take the dogs out and exercise them. Then come home and write, you know. I never do it. But, I need that sort of discipline to write more of my stuff. Farrell of Kevin says, what was your favorite design of a Batman villain in the animated series? Favorite design of a Batman villain in the animated series? Bruce's original design of Joker was really awesome. And I loved his version of Catwoman with the gray and the black and the little belt.
Yeah.
I think that's probably my favorite design of Catwoman anywhere, with the simple gray outfit, with the long black gloves and the high black boots, and it just...
That was not from anything either that I can recall, was it? That's pretty much his own take on it. And
yeah.
It's so iconic for her.
Yeah, it's just a beautiful, elegant look. It looks it looks terrific. So, you know, a toss-up between Catwoman and the Joker. Harley, of course, is awesome because he gave her the mask with those huge eyes and the little floppy tassels. She looks kind of like a demented Boston Terrier sometimes. So we've got a lot of them. Clayface.
Clayface was really great. That was good.
And I really think it took 3 tries. But once he got the final Scarecrow design, the Hanged Man design...
Oh, yeah.
I don't think anybody's ever come up with a scary version of Scarecrow. That's a really terrific version of it. This is interesting. Kendra Navarro says, how do you read the last page of The Killing Joke, or what's your opinion on Morrison's revelation? Well, there's been, this is about the current debate in comic circles about Morrison came out and he said, well, if you look closely, Batman kills the Joker at the end of Killing Joke. They're laughing, and then he kind of reaches out and, his hands on his shoulder, and then you hear the sirens coming, but you don't hear the laughter anymore. And so it's like Batman, you know, snapped the Joker's neck.
Like the joking of it all just got to him, and he finally snapped and...
They're both laughing, they share this moment, and then he laughs and he puts his hand on the Joker's neck and snaps it.
Hmm. I didn't even hear about that.
I think that if Batman snapped the Joker's neck, he'd just continue laughing. I think he'd laugh out of relief. Like,
yeah.
You know, they're both laughing, and Joker's, ha, 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 ha. And Batman would probably go, Batman probably couldn't stop himself from laughing. And it would probably go into, like, shrieks of kind of almost insane laughter. I mean, I did this, I'm putting my own thing on, transposing it, but that in Batman Beyond, when Robin kills the Joker, he goes from laughing to crying.
Yeah.
And that's kind of powerful. How I think that Batman would do the same thing. He'd laugh and then probably just keep laughing, and then he'd probably just kind of go a bit mad himself. I always thought that it was sort of like they shared this weird little laugh. It's like a laugh out of it's a relief more than anything,
mm-hmm.
a release more than anything. You know, they both have this release because it's an intense thing they've gone through. The sirens are continuing, and then he just takes the Joker and just throws him in a car and goes home and nurses his wounds or something like that. But if Morrison, you know, wait a minute, Alan Moore wrote that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Alan Moore wrote that. Yeah, Morrison.
Well, no, right? I think Morrison says... That's how he read the ending of it.
And then
it's like, yeah. But I always read it like, you know, the rain just, you know, it's silence and the rain just falls. And I don't even really know that that's happening in any sort of sequential, you know, like immediate sequential time. It could be a few minutes after that. I just sort of feel like the joke's over, you know, and they just sort of don't have anything to say to each other anymore. And Joker goes away for next time. You know, it's like you can read these things into... You know, read these things a thousand different ways. But, you know, I can't... My big thing about Batman is, like, the Joker, I think, would really twist on him. Is like, you can't kill me because by killing me, it would invalidate your existence. Yeah. Who else would you have? Penguin? Good luck with that. Oh, the bunch of the other second raiders? I mean, come on. You keeping me alive validates your existence. And we both know it. Which is kind of sick on Batman's part, but I don't know. IQ writes, when you wrote for Ewoks, did you have any feedback from Lucasfilm or the maker himself? Yeah, that was a long time ago. When I wrote Ewoks, yes, George Lucas read every script and he'd make comments on them. And
in charge of all of his properties for that
series. Yeah, he'd come in and watch Rough Cuts animation. We'd watch it with him and he'd make suggestions for cuts or for... Usually he'd watch the animatic, and when he'd point out things that he felt weren't working or were working or things we might want to play up. Generally, the way that happened early on was, this is back in 1984, I went up and talked to him at length about the Ewoks and about what he thought, you know, how to translate, you know, these characters that didn't speak English into, you know, a series for kids. Joe Johnston had already worked on a book about the Ewoks and had written kind of a children's story about them by, you know, giving them names and mm-hmm. sort of personalities. So I was sort of building off that also. But as I remember that conversation, we talked a lot about comics we liked and children's books we liked. And we talked a lot about Carl Barks, Uncle Scrooge and comics mm-hmm. and Pogo and things like that. And we had a lot of common ground that I could say, well, how about like this, like in Pogo or... you know, like the little Ewoks are always sort of running around the background, like the little kids in Pogo, or, you know, we have these adventures on like old ruined structures, like, you know, in old mines or old traps, like Uncle Scrooge, and he would go for that, you know, because we were speaking very common ground. And basically, he wasn't around for a lot of that, but he was around if we needed him. And he read all the scripts and he gave his approval on them. He was much more involved on Clone Wars, as I understand it, working with Henry Gilroy and Dave Filoni. And I did not work with him face-to-face, although we would communicate by emails. And I'd mostly communicate with him through Henry or through, you know, like I would get an outline that he had written and say, why don't you write a script on this? And I would take it and do it like that. I was invited to move back to the ranch, and I appreciated the offer, but, you know, it had been 30 years. I'd gotten married. I have a house here. Yeah. I can't take off the whole month of October to go back to Skywalker, as much as I would have loved it at one point in my life. And I do love and I do enjoy visiting when I'm up there. You know, I'll call up friends I still have. I went up with Henry last fall, and we spent a wonderful day out there, you know, running around the office and seeing everything and saying hi to everybody. But, you know, that was that. No, it was fun working on Ewoks. Actually, Ewoks have their own comic book based on kind of based on the old animated show. Dark Horse is doing a new one, and
really
looks a lot more kick-ass than our show ever was. So I'm pretty excited. They're actually playing them. They use the same names like Wicket and Nisa and yeah. Latara and Tebow, but they actually play them as sort of I always wanted to play them, which is like more like little kick-ass warriors and more depth to their personality. Because at this time it was on Saturday morning and it was all kind of limp and wishy-washy, and I could never take the characters as far as I wanted. So somebody's doing it now and it looks really great. So I'm
going
to make a point to pick that up.
Yeah.
Any chance for a third generation Green Lantern video game starring Jon Stewart? Well, I will mention that to the guys over at Warner Video if I ever speak to them again. Tower Prep Films. It's a lot to answer these questions, but it would be very helpful to stop from going crazy. Oh, I guess he has some questions. We'll get to those. Jester Wish. If his life force will be sucked dry by this first date, then yes, she needs to feed. I don't know
what that
means. I don't know.
These are getting stranger as you're going, Paul.
Well, it was sent to Mark Evanier, too, so maybe he has some clue as to what that's about. Derek Armijo says, any differing opinions on Killing Joke now and the Batman Kills the Joker in theory that is... Oh, I just answered that. Okay. Pink Magenta Beetle says, when you thought of Harley Quinn for the first time, did you think of her as a character that would become the Joker's girlfriend? Yes. Yeah. I mean, maybe their relationship wasn't as clearly defined, but I like the idea of somebody who had... It was like I wasn't really sure where I was going with her, but I thought initially that she was somebody, the type of girl who writes to a guy, a killer in prison. You know, there are people who write to killers in prison and say...
Like people that marry killers in prison.
Yes, that's who Harley was originally in my mind, was somebody who had a fixation on the Joker. And, you know, that type of personality would be like, you define my existence, I'm the one who can change you, or I'm the one who understands you. So.
Yeah.
That was kind of before a lot of anything else was in my head, you know, that was sort of in my head. Tower Prep Headmaster. Give Tower Prep Films and Tower Prep Headmaster a shout out. Okay, guys, you got your shout out. Hooray. Thank you for, he also asked, what is Ian's connection to Cornelius Tower and who is the Tunnel Man? The Tunnel Man was somebody who knew the secrets and who was going on and has a connection to Cornelius Tower. There were some things we had either deliberately left vague or we had some arguments about in the writer's room. And it's like, let's put it in now. Let's figure it out later. But we know this guy is solidly connected to Cornelius. It was the same with Ian's connection to Cornelius. We knew they were connected. We knew that he wasn't Ian's grandfather. We knew that. But there was a very solid connection between the two of them in their past. So a lot of these things we had... introducing the show, they said these are going to be a big part of season two. Let's put a pin in them for now. We have ideas pinned up as to who these guys exactly are, but when we come back for season two, we are going to answer these questions. And then we didn't get a season two. So, Stingray Travel, during you were Florida, what did you visit Orlando theme parks? What do you think of Potter and Spider-Man ride? Also, Man of Steel film. I've not been to the Orlando parks. I've not seen the Harry Potter Village, though I think Misty would like to go back and see that. She'd like to visit the village. But she's not all that fond of Florida, so I think she'll wait till they build one here and then she'll go see it. Spider-Man, I'd seen the ride, the graphics for the ride before, so I didn't really need to go on the ride, but I've seen, you know, the ride looks great. And Man of Steel film, what can I say? It's not my Superman. You know?
Yeah.
I appreciated a lot of things about the movie, but ultimately I didn't feel it was my Superman. Let's see. Drumhill 557 says, any plans to return to Batman comics? Yeah, I've got a short story illustrated by Stefan Rue in the November issue of Batman Black and White.
Oh, very nice.
So there we go. What does TP Headmaster writes, what does Corvus H40 really do? What was his purpose? Let's see. One of those kind of mute, one of those, man, I'm forgetting, and then was the purpose of Chemicadescent 2.0. One of those took away their powers or wiped their powers out or something like that. I don't know. I'm going to have to, it's now reached a point with Tower Prep where the fans know more than I do. I have to go back and check my files. let's see. Foster House VHX. Max was a great character in Batman Beyond, but she wasn't in Return of the Joker or JLU's epilogue. What became of her? Again, you know, we just never had room for her in those stories. I mean, mm-hmm. she does have a place and she does have an end to her story. But, you know, we never say never with these shows. Somebody always picks them up, and it might be 10 years from now. It might be 2 months from now, but somebody will pick up the characters.
Is Beechin still doing the comics?
I think so, yeah. He might continue the story there. Eduardo Reb, what are your thoughts on writing for kids show movies now in comparison to when you started out? Well, the whole landscape of children's television has changed. I mean, this is one thing I hear over and over again, and I don't believe it, you know, necessarily entirely, but some networks will tell you that kids have many more viewing choices, and they're not going to sit through like a title sequence or an end sequence. So get the show started quickly. No title sequence. Start off with action. Show your hero from the beginning and feature them in every shot all the way through the thing. I think that that works on some shows, not so much on other shows. I think that there is like a lot more creativity involved for the writing in a lot of shows. I think especially with a creator-owned show, with something like Adventure Time, that really is the process, you know, out of Pendleton Ward's head and his crew. I think that's a terrific example of a show that exists because of his unique vision. I think that Samurai Jack was similar to that. I think that Avatar shows are like that. I think SpongeBob is like that. You know, there are a lot of good shows, and that just come directly from the creator's head that I think are really terrific. And I like to see that. So I think that there are a lot more advantages for writers now. Especially writer artists or writers who work very well with an art team. And I think that kids will always gravitate to something they think is smart and cool. And so you have to kind of trust the kids. Let's see. Evanier says, Mark Evanier says, should a boy allow himself to be kissed on the first date? Yes. Should a boy allow himself to be kissed on the first date? Yes, by all means. It depends on who's doing the kissing, but
especially if she's going for it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's getting kind of be a loaded question these days. I mean, because it's not just boys and girls kissing, it's girls and boys kissing. So I think, if there's mutual consent, by all means. I don't know how to answer this. It's a snarky question from Evan here. Yeah. And I don't have his gift for snark, so I'm just trying to do a realistic app. Yes, unless they're dating Mark Evanier, in which case.
Zing.
There you go. Then at least make him pay for, get Mark to pay for dinner three times before giving him a kiss. Let's see. Jester Witch. Hi, Paul. Great seeing you at Comic-Con this year. Have you ever experienced any strange occurrences in your life? Oh, my God. Where do I begin? Have you ever experienced any strange occurrences in your life? Yeah, a little bit. Look who I married. I married a magician, so that's strange.
That's filled with strange.
Yeah. At one point I did this cartoon. You know, Jay Bone did this cartoon of me, and it actually showed up in a publicity photo of me walking around whistling, and there were all these things after me, and some of them were my own characters, and some of them were things like poisonous snakes and attacking animals and pirates with machine guns, and there was a rhino charging me, and there was a bear, and there was all this other shit, all this stuff after me, you know, like various things just pursuing me. And all those things have actually happened to me at some point in my life.
I say a lot of these things I remember you mentioning. So
yeah. I mean, it's quite, you know, I've run into monsters and ghosts and things like that. I mean, I've had things that I experienced that I can only chalk up to being like ghost encounters and things like that, because the situation was so bizarre, my brain can't process it in any other way. I've, you know, seen bizarre animals all over the world. I got chased by a gang of pirates. I got, you know,
Komodo dragons.
I mean, you know, bizarre yeah. shit happens to me all the time. Yeah. I mean, you know, granted, a spaceship never picked me up like Grant Morrison, but yeah. you know, but you know, pretty much everything else has. So, yeah, sure. You know, I could write a book. Maybe I should. let's see. TB Headmaster again writes, there's a rumor going around you were at court with CN and you were filming a spinoff of 2P. Please put these rumors to rest. Yes, I'm at court with CN.
Cartoon Network.
What, I'm taking them to court? No, nothing like that. I work with a guy named Court Lane on the Spider-Man and Hulk show, but that's the only court I know.
I was for some reason thinking like a royal court. You're at court with them and they were... charming you, and I don't know.
Well, it's sort of, well, that's what it sounds like, but it's at court. Sounds like I'm taking them to court.
Yeah.
No, you know, I'm not working for Cartoon Network, but I've, you know, there's no ill will there or anything like that, and we're certainly not, you know, going at it legally. And I'm not doing any spinoff on Tower Prep. If anything, I am working on new things all the time, and I'm working on projects that I hope will take off and be, a lot more successful and better than Tower Prep. Even though I love Tower Prep dearly, it's mm-hmm. it's not coming back anytime soon. And so it's like, I don't want to spend any more time kind of crying over spilled milk. So I'm working on a bunch of other things. So Joseph Catch says, top 10 Batman villains, favorite episodes of Justice League other than Epilogue. Top 10 Batman villains. Okay. Joker, Penguin, Riddler, Catwoman, Two-Face. I just can't put Harley in there. That'd be too... Poison Ivy, Mr. Freeze.
Oh, yeah.
I like Tweedledum and Tweedledee.
Oh, those are fun.
Ra's al Ghul. Who gets the last spot?
Does that handyman count as a villain?
The handyman?
Yeah, or the girl who sets up all the traps.
Oh, God. I created her. I'm not even going to put her in. I'm not even going to put her in the top 20. I guess I'll go Mad Hatter.
Oh, that's a good choice.
Yeah.
Especially the Roddy McDowell one. Oh, that was some good stuff.
Yeah, he was really good. I really liked him. Did I say Two-Face?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And favorite episodes of Justice League other than Epilogue? I really like that one with the ones where the villains snuck on board the satellite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was a great one with Plastique and the villains, you know, infiltrating the satellite.
Mm-hmm.
That was just phenomenal. That was wonderful writing.
Great. The Clock King was involved and stuff.
And, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyone Dwayne wrote was really great. The one about Hawkgirl and Solomon Grundy was terrific.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
Yeah, there's so many. I just have to sit down and watch them all again. Let's see. Elias Tafwed said... We all know if Tower Prep continued, Ian would have been leader of the gnomes. What would CJ, Gabe, and Suki become? CJ would have... be supporting her father, although grudgingly. Suki would have blended back in with the crowd, but she would be like the girl at the end of the remake of Body Snatchers trying to pass as one of them while still trying to figure out what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And Gabe was going to be imprisoned. Gabe was going to go back to the West Campus and was going to be in lockdown. And nobody was allowed to talk to him because of his powers of persuasion. So it was up to Suki to kind of snap CJ out of her headmaster's control and then bring Ian back. And then they were going to rescue Gabe. So that's how the first couple was going to work out. Also, Fenton was going to be heavily involved. Fenton was going to be a regular in season two.
Nice.
And Ray was going to become more of a hero. He would do more heroic things, but he would be off doing them for himself, and he'd still be antagonistic with Ian.
Yeah.
But it's more like, I'm doing things for the school and for Suki, and I don't really care what Ian's guys are doing. I'm doing this, and he was going to go off and discover some stuff on his own. And Fenton was going to kind of join as sort of like their version of like a Sherlock Holmes or Q type character, or some very bright character, but still kind of a funny character. License Farm. What's the order of backwards names? And let's see. What's the order of backwards names in the Latinesque lyrics to the theme Batman: Mask of the Phantasm? First is you'd have to be a real geek to know this. The opening of Mask of the Phantasm. There, you hear this very operatic singing.
Uh-huh.
It's actually the names of the creators and the different people involved in the show sung backwards.
Oh my goodness.
Like. a mock Latin-esque type way.
Yeah.
So
I'm familiar with the song. I didn't realize that's what it was. That's great.
Yeah. TP Headmaster, what's really going on at Tower Prep? What is the purpose that Headmaster is restoring it from? The idea was Tower Prep was going to be a very benevolent place, but mysterious place where kids all over the world were brought to Mac to develop their special abilities. But the idea was that there was a evil group that had infiltrated the school, and Headmaster didn't have any proof they were there, but he suspected they were there. And he dropped Ian into the middle of it to sort, because he had this sort of pre-flex ability, allowing him to be one step ahead of any, you know, people, to sort of find out what was going on. Headmaster is his point of view was, evil is threatening the school. The school has to remain strict and distant and mysterious for the sake of these kids. They have to adhere to the discipline of the school in order to succeed at what they do. Or if they can't, they wind up broken and running off into the forest, like with the other broken kids in Red Fang. And now we've discovered that their evil people have infiltrated the school, who probably had a connection to Cornelius Tower and the ones who were like the evil board members that we saw in one episode. They're making another try to get into the school through the kids. I'm bringing in this kid, and I'm going to be harder on him than I am with anybody, because I want him to try and escape. I want him to find out secrets, because through him, I'll discover what's really on here. Mm-hmm. Sort of like being like a drill sergeant, being a real bastard on somebody because he knows he's the only one who can succeed. So I kind of like that relationship in fiction anyway, where somebody is really like working somebody, and the person is kind of a bastard themselves, but he and the hero are fighting for the same ends. It's a little, it wasn't quite Snape and Harry Potter.
I was just going to say, there's an element of that in Harry Potter.
There was an element of that. Yeah, but there was like, I always got the idea that Snape never really would have embraced Harry and been all that friendly to
without
him, because
Dumbledore.
He's just too close to Lily. It's just too painful. This is Lily's kid. I could have had a kid like this, and he's going to be different, and he's still half James, and I fucking hate James Potter, and I will always hate James Potter, and whatever there is of James Potter in this kid, I hate it, but I still love Lily, so ask of me what you will. I always thought Snape was just a really terrific character.
Yeah.
Anyway, J. Villain 78, what was the inspiration behind Two of a Kind, one of the best Batman stories ever? I'm glad you like that. We had to do a new take on Harley Quinn. They wanted to bring her in the show, and they didn't really want to do the Mad Love origin, so we made Harley kind of what she was in, or what she set out to be, which was a pop psychiatrist with a TV show, and somebody who really kind of got in people's heads whether they wanted her to be there or not, and irritated the hell out of people, like a lot of people with talk shows. And so that also led to her, you know, and the Joker kind of had a fixation on her because of, you know, the fact that she was so wacky. I love the idea that we got to do that Hank Williams song in there.
Oh, yeah.
God bless Michael Jelinek. I said, you know what would really sell this? A Hank Williams song in the middle of it. And he said, okay, why not? Put it in. We'll see how it works or not.
Wow.
So we put in Set in the Woods on
Fire.
Yeah.
I can't believe when people allow stuff like that.
I love to experiment in cartoons. It's the only thing that makes them fun.
Yeah.
So, and even if the experiment doesn't work out really well and people wind up running me out on a rail, at least I tried something.
Yeah.
Tom Casey says, why for you smash me into mighty oak tree? I'm awfully sorry about that. Thomas Andrews
must be
said,
enjoying your Hulk Agents of Smash.
I suppose. One can assume. Silbot 98, Thomas Andrews says, how can we get a hold of Darren Morgan? Oh, if only we could. I think Darren spends half his time in the land of pixies or far, far away. I don't know how to get in touch with Darren Morgan. So when you find him, say hi for me. Silbot 98, where can I listen to it? This must be for the podcast. At RadioRashi.com. Deviator into 77. What's your favorite subsequent use of a character you created? I don't know. I kind of like it when I create a character, like this is for the comics, when somebody picks them up and dusts them off and then uses them again. You know, like I was making fun of the Carpenter earlier, but then I noticed a few people had used her here and there and mm-hmm. worked her into some stories and stuff like that. And I kind of like that. It says like, okay, that wasn't a bad idea I had. Or it was a bad idea and somebody else was amused by it and they decided to do something with it. I love it when anybody takes a character like that because I feel like I went out and bought a new toy for the toy box and contributed it to it. You know, throw it in and it's sort of like, it's there for everybody to play off. There's been a lot of really great stuff with Harley Quinn done. And I read a story that's coming up also in Batman Black and White. There's a Harley story in there that's one of the funniest things I've ever read. And it is just great. Oh, it was so good that I read it and I was going, and Joe Quinones drew it. And I was going like, and I'm blanking on the writer's name. I'm sorry, because mm-hmm. it was a really terrific story. But, I like it when anybody picks it up and does something.
Speaking of which, Harley's getting her new series again.
Here. She is, and I'm very excited.
That should be fun.
I'm very excited because Jimmy and Amanda Connor, Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor, congratulations, newlyweds, are doing the...
They're newlyweds? Oh, congratulations to them.
Yes.
Oh, great.
I Am the Black Swan writes, why the hell are you not writing the new Batman game? I wasn't asked. Plain and simple. I asked the guys at Warner Interactive. I said, you want me to leave time to write a third one when we were debuting the second one? They said, nope. All the games are going to be staff written from now on. So no outsiders. Sorry. Thanks for your work. But all staff written from this point on. Bye-bye. And let's see. Nightwing 99. Which podcast? Kevin's? No. The podcast you want to listen to is Radio Rashi on RadioRashi.com.
Maybe we should do a reply on Twitter so they know.
Yes. No, I haven't been on Kevin's podcast. People want me to go back on Fat Man on Batman, but have to be invited. Astro Warp says, link on your main site for the podcast is broken, at least for me anyways. Ooh, we better check that out.
Yeah,
We'll check that out. And we want you to listen to that. Let's see. Who are your influences in literature, Mr. As You Write writes? Or influences in literature? I'll just run down a fast list. James Thurber, Woody Allen, Sam Shepard, John Steinbeck, Charles Dickens, William Inge, Stan Lee, Carl Barks, Walt Kelly, who else? There were guys I just, George Orwell, guys I just devoured in school. Flannery O'Connor, I can't leave out Flannery O'Connor.
Yeah.
There's 11, I'm sure there, I've got a dozen more that are just as important, but somewhere in there you can sift through those and Those are a fast lift.
Speaking of Thurber, you see the trailer for Secret Life of Walter Mitty?
I saw it. I haven't heard it yet. I mean,
so fun.
I watched it with the sound off for whatever reason.
I just was amazed by it. Looks exciting.
Who's in that? Ben Stiller.
Ben Stiller, yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
I haven't seen your, The Real Rebels says, I haven't seen your name in comics recently. What's up? Could be I've missed them, so let me know if they... Or if I have. I haven't been writing monthly comics for a while. I've just been working on animation and I've been working on some other development stuff. So I can't do both at once. So when the new 52 came in, that sort of uprooted me from the comics work I'd been doing because they had changed Zatanna and Batman and a bunch of other stuff. So I just took that as my, break from comics. And it's not that I haven't had offers. I had some really wonderful offers from some astonishingly wonderful publishers and some great creative people, but I'm really taking this as a time off where I can develop some of my own stuff and a little break from the monthly grind. And the more time I have, I can devote to the cartoons, which I'm really loving. Let's see. Rogue Hero 89. Any chance on coming to one of Australia's mini cons? Sure, invite me. I've turned down the a couple of invites before because the timing didn't work out right. Australia, I would love to go and I'd love to meet Australian fans and I love Australia. It's such a time commitment that I would have to, I'd have to block it off and I would want Misty to come with me and she would have to block off her time. So that would have to be something that we really have to plan for. I just can't run off to Australia and leave her with the dogs and You know, what would the Hulk do without me? You know, sit there and cry. So I'd have to block the time. But sure, you know, if it worked out time-wise, I'd love to come to Australia and do a convention. Let's see. As a writer, what drives you more, a plot or character? It's character all the way. I mean, sometimes I might think of a really good plot element or a real snazzy, you know, twist to a visual or something, and that'll propel a story. But if I can't figure out a way to make it work character-wise, then I abandon it, because I don't want to put myself in a trap where I'm just writing about, you know, the frosting. You need some cake to put it on.
Yeah.
Any Batmillion you wanted to write that you haven't yet? Pretty much got all of them. Let's see. If you could completely reboot any comic character, who, why, and what would you do differently? Spacker 46. You know, I've been lucky enough to work on all the characters that I wanted to work on. Now it's just about coming up with something of my own. You know, the more I work on other people's characters, I love it, and I always love it, but it's just fired me to say, okay, I want to get something going and, you know, get my own characters out there. And even if there are things like Ida Red and Jingle Bell and Madame Mirage that just amuse me, at the end of the day, I just like playing with kind of my own toys and putting them out there. And even if I'm the only one who reads them, hopefully somebody likes them. Anyway,
Someone else. I enjoy them.
Thank you. Let's see. Any plans to return to Batman Comics? I think I answered that one already. Mm-hmm. I think that may be... let's see. Pit Stoff writes, you wrote some of the 80s most popular cartoons. If somebody gave you the license to do a gem reboot, how would you approach it? I would give it to Beth Bornstein and have her write it. Beth Bornstein is an old friend of mine from college, and she also wrote several episodes of Gem and did a damn fine good job. So I would get the job and just say to Beth, here, you take it. You love these girls, and you write them a lot better than I ever could. So you do it.
Yeah, she's truly outrageous.
Yes, she is.
Truly, truly outrageous.
Yes. Moon Mallow, any more plans for Madame Mirage? Yes, lots. But yeah. I can't talk about it right now. And OJ Queen says, anything you can tell us about your upcoming Batman black and white story? Yes, it's drawn by Stefan Rue. It has Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy in it and a brand new villain. And it's kind of a fun, creepy story. Let's see. Of all your Batman episodes, Big Chaunt 64 writes, which was your favorite? Also, how'd you crack the Mr. Freeze character in Heart of Ice? We decided he was unemotional, so what makes an unemotional man emotional? So, you know, if I have no emotions and I'm dead to emotion, okay, I don't believe you. What do you have? What's going to make you cry? Once you figure that out, here's your story. Matt 1X writes, question for your podcast. What was it like working with Kevin Conroy and Mark Hamill through the years? Beautiful. It was wonderful. Every time, you know, it was like a sunny day every time they came in to record together. There they were, and it's just like, did I think like, oh, we're making, you know, a treasured classic that kids are going to love? No, but it really, you never really think that. But there they were together, and they were going out. I mean, a little now that the characters have kind of reach that stature, so when I work on a video game and they're both in it, mm-hmm. or the rare times that I work on something now that they're both in, the closest I came to that was we did a Batman
Brave and the Bold,
where Mark played the Spectre, and Kevin
and
was
Ken
in
played the
Thomas Wayne.
Yeah, that was,
I mean,
a great episode.
There's always magic, but even then,
you
after
had
that,
Adam West too,
yeah,
like three generations,
yeah, after that, we did the Arkham game. So even though they did record those mostly solo, but still, you know, I was at Comic-Con with them not like 2 years ago. We were on a panel and it's like, here's the boys. It's fun. You know, it's great. Anytime they get together and they can become those characters, they're terrific. Let's see. Mike Fitz, 538, cast your dream JLA movie with actors. Or characters.
That's what casting usually means, but that's another choice. Like, not only do you have to cast, but you have to pick which JLA.
I would use all 52 members of the Justice League that Bruce used in his show.
Yeah.
Right. Here's my Justice League movie.
Yeah.
I don't know who plays what character? I don't, you know, we'd have, you know, you just mix people up or find some unknowns or get some stars. But it would star pretty much every member of the Justice League that was in Justice League Unlimited, even if they were just background characters. Because my take on this would be the Justice League has been in existence for a while. There's that satellite up in space. They're all there. And it's not a Superman movie with Batman and a bunch of other characters in there. It's a DC Universe movie. Mm-hmm. It's Superman and Batman and Aquaman and Buona Beast and The Flash and Green Lantern and Hawk Girl, Black Canary, and Deadman. Not, probably not Deadman. Plastic Man, Zatanna, Martian Manhunter. They're all up there. Vibe, yeah. Okay, why not? Vibe, Gypsy, you know.
You said everyone from that series. That's a
Vibe, Gypsy, there. Booster Gold, yeah. The Blue Beetle. They're all up there, and you give them all roles, and you make the movie about these unique people who've come together to save the world, and you make it a lot of, you know, about a character story. You don't think about a plot. You don't think about what gets them all together. You, for God's sake, you don't make it an origin story. But maybe your everyman characters are Booster Gold and Blue Beetle, who find themselves, you know, how do I relate to, you know, Wonder Woman smiled at me today. I mean, really? What do you think she meant by it? I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. She never smiles at me. You know, it's, what do you make of it? I don't know. You know, Flash has been real friendly to me lately. You know, like these two guys, you know, are like, they're kind of like, they're lumped in among everybody else, but maybe they don't have the reputations among mankind that Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman has, you know. You know, no matter how hard they try, Green Arrow is never nice to them. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't know what to make of Batman, you know. And then you have separate stories. Then you have Fire, Ice, Gypsy, Wonder Woman, and they're on their own story. You know, what are these characters like as personalities, you know, and how do they relate to each other? And then you have them save the world or something. But, you know, you make it really kind of like an intense character story. And then you don't stay, you know, it isn't an out-and-out comedy, but, you know, there are guys who wear suits all the time. The DC Universe I always felt was a lighter in tone universe than the Marvel Universe. Mm-hmm. Marvel Universe is really wonderful, but it's about characters who really shouldn't be together, who have to be together, and who kind of put their neuroses on parade and then kind of function around that. And the DC Universe is more like these legendary characters all working together. These are characters that are, I don't know, like the Knights of the Round Table or the Greek gods or something, and it's how they relate to each other. So
yeah.
It isn't a big Superman movie, but certainly he's a part of it. You know, Wonder Woman is a part of it, and they all know each other, and they know each other's secret identity, and they keep the secrets or whatever. And they're also, one of the things I really liked about the Justice League show was they're regular people who work there on the satellite, you know, who man the satellite and who are the staff and keep it running. You know, don't, you know, accept it for what it is. Don't figure out, you know, how do we explain that they come together, and how do we do Wonder Woman's origin, and how is Aquaman able to have this kingdom on their, don't think about it. You're wasting way too much time thinking about it. Approach it as a kid approaches the comic book, with that sort of, you know, suspension of disbelief. There is a kingdom under the sea ruled by Aquaman, and he works with other heroes. Buy it. Buy into the magic.
Yeah.
You know, you buy into the magic the same way, like, there's a school in England called Hogwarts, and it's run by wizards and witches. Okay, you can buy into it. You know, you just buy into the magic and craft your story out of that. And then, you know, okay, then there's this great organization. Oh, look, you know, a bunch of guys escape from jail. They're going to have a rival organization led by Lex Luthor. Uh-oh, looks bad for Earth. What are we going to do? And then, you know, come up with a story about that. Don't try and, it's not real. It's not the real world. We work so hard to put Superman in Man of Steel in a real world that it just, the movie, I can't buy it anymore. The filmmakers can't buy it anymore. There's all of Metropolis being laid waste. There should be people dropping out of buildings, screaming, falling to their death. What's their explanation? Yeah, we decided not to go there. But we're showing the buildings getting ruined. But, you know, the only person who was really in trouble was Perry White and Lois Lane and a couple of others here and there. Mm-hmm. It's like, no. You're not in the real world. You know, you're just ignoring things. The movie and the concept has become too heavy for you. Lighten up.
Yeah.
Justice League movie has about 30 to 40 heroes and heroines in it. And they, you know, maybe, so maybe Plastic Man only gets four lines of dialogue. Maybe Black Canary is a walk-on in the distance, but at least they're there. You know, they're doing stuff. So, you know, you figure out the dynamics of that group and what is intrinsically interesting about characters who can turn themselves into tornadoes or shapeshift or great detectives or whatever. And then you're going to get a story in there. But, you know, these things are so often driven by studio edict, and especially a studio that really doesn't get the concept, and then by marketing, and then consumer products, and the whole thing just sort of collapses on itself. So that's my rant. Anyway, I'm done. So I think that's it for all the questions today. One guy just asked, what the F? So I don't know.
Yeah.
what the F indeed. But anyway, that's what we got, and I think we're at least an hour, are we?
Oh, we're 90 minutes.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then let's call it. Thank you very much for tuning in. Another 90 minutes of blather, pure blather, and weird, unfounded opinion from me. And next week, Misty will be back, and we'll have more stuff to talk about. What, you want to say anything, Hobart? Yeah, I thought you'd say that. Anyway, thanks, Ezra. See you next week.
See ya.
Take care.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes Store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.